Pod. 22 grand. Pod. In the city that sounds nice. Hello and welcome to the third episode of the 22 grand pod podcast. For this episode, Tom of the Paddingtons rejoined me to talk to one of his old friends from back in the day, Dominic Masters of The Others. After forming in 2002, The Others went on to have a big influence on the rock and roll scene in the noughties, known for their guerrilla gigs and their loyal fan base known as the 853 Kamikaze Stage Diving Division. Dominic was able to join me and Tom on a Friday night in lockdown, and just to note that it was a video call, so there are some visual references, including a couple to my terrible lockdown moustache.
Nice to see you first, Dom.
Yeah, well, I'm still alive, but just no one sees me anymore. I think what happens is that you go out of public sort of focus and stuff like that, and you're just not needed, and then you get wheeled out for a podcast every 15 years to prove that you're still alive, you know? Oh, he's still alive. That's all right. We'll see him in 15 years. So, you know, I'm looking forward to 2035 Others podcast with you, Harry, talking about what would probably be my fifth album or sixth album by then.
If you're lucky.
I'm lucky.
Where do you say you're living now, Dom?
I'm in the middle of nowhere these days.
Okay, right.
What I just decided is, a few years ago, I just thought, you know what it's like? I wanted to live in the East End, and that's all where I ever wanted to be.
Right.
And I really loved the East End, and it meant a lot to me. But I was being priced out every year, you know?
Yeah.
It's hard to compete against families where, you know, mummy and daddy are paying Zachariah and Bethany's deposit.
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
You know, and Zachariah and Bethany need that Hackney apartment more than Dominic Masters needs it for living in the East End for 20 years. And so Zachariah and Bethany from, you know, some very rich, high-class school get that over me. So in the end, I had to sort of move out. You know, I'm certainly not in zone one and two anymore. You know, that's beyond my price range. Yeah, you know, where are you then? Are you in Manchester?
In Manchester, yeah, in Sale, just outside of it.
You're in Sale?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, I know Sale. No, I do know Sale. So my mum's boyfriend, so why I'm a... This is a Manchester City fan mug from when I was... something like 11 years old, so this is 29 years old. Well, my 42, 31 years old. Right. He was a City fan, and his sister Wendy lived in Sale, so we used to go over there.
Right,
that's how I remember it.
Oh, nice one.
It's weird that you remind me of the it's called Mindhorn. Do you know,
what, Howard Moon?
Yeah, Mindhorn. You look a bit like him.
I love that film.
I love it. I watched it for the first time about a month ago, and I was like, why have I never watched Mindhorn?
That's all the songs he does are actually ace, like You Can't Handcuff the Wind.
Yeah. Honestly, anyone out there that's got nothing to do this period at home, do watch Mindhorn. It was a few laughs, which I don't know, that came easy.
Trying to remember what we used to eat at your flat off Brick Lane. Remember that place?
Oh, that was gorgeous. The second one you probably went to, which was the one where it was the big room, where we had the big room.
Yeah.
Rich Brown was there. Rich Brown, the other Manchester City fan.
I can't really remember.
Remember Lewis? Remember Lewis Jones?
Oh, yeah, of course. I remember Lewis.
Yeah. So Lewis Jones's best mate was my best mate, Richard Brown. And if you watch the Stan Bowles video, which is obviously, you know, one of our top 40 hits, may I add.
Oh, yeah.
You've got Richard Brown wearing a Man City shirt of the time playing football in that Stan Bowles video.
Right. Ah, shit. Yeah, I remember that. That was a top 20 hit in my eyes, Dom.
I think it got 35 or something.
Yeah, we had a couple of them as well.
I think Blackie went in at 21, which was pretty good.
Yeah, we had panic. And then,
I think William went in at 29. Stan Bowles went in at 35. So, you know, a few top 40 hits.
Yeah, that'll do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I remember that song. That was one of my favourite ones, I think. It was about Pete, wasn't it?
Well, it's a good reference to Pete because you've got the lyric, you know, he was a Queen's Park Rangers fan and QPR 1975. Now, if you're a bit of a football historian, the best ever Queen's Park Rangers team, that best ever QPR team, is the 75 team where they blew the league, came second, Liverpool nudged them by a point, City were also up for the league and they fucked it up as well. And QPR were basically top of the league all season. You know, Jerry Francis, Stan Bowles, great side. And I thought there was a lot of parallels between Stan Bowles at the QPR team and obviously our intrepid Peter and QPR. So, you know, I thought the parallels were there.
Looking back at that era, you obviously like played a massive part with Eagle Rilla gigs and stuff. Like, what do you remember from that time? Do you think of it as a unique era now?
This is the way I look at it. You know, music comes in cycles and it comes in phases. So, you know, Tom probably heard me reference this same speech back in 2003, 2004. And you get cycles and little periods where things are good and things are not so good. So, you know, if we go through the cycle of great creativity, which you guys know is rock and roll, and that's our kind of passion. It's not everybody's passion these days, and it may be not even the teenager's passion anymore, rock and roll. But when it was, and it was a period of music where the teenagers right through to the old people listened to guitar music, you had good periods, you know. So you had the late 60s and the early 70s, and then we had punk, you know, and then after punk we have a Stone Roses period. You know, if we take out the bad, some bad stuff that happened in the 80s. And then, you know, you go from Roses and Mondays into another period of kind of nothingness until we come into, you know, Oasis and Blur sort of territory, and then nothingness for a little while, and then you had that White Stripes, Soledad Brothers sort of Detroit revival, and then on the back of that you had another scene coming in with the Libertines, and then obviously it was us. And you get scenes, and okay, you get a bit of a barren patch in between scenes, and we just came into that cycle. I would say we made it unique by creating a scene from nothing. So the trickiest thing was having no fans initially. Going out and you're playing first on the bill, and I'm thinking, okay, how the hell do we get from first of the bill upwards? So then, you know, I started advertising our concerts on the Libertines forums, for instance, so people would hear about them. And then because we used to play maybe the crappier nights of the week, the others playing 7:30 p.m. on a Tuesday. The others playing 8 p.m. on a Wednesday. The others playing, you know, 9 o'clock, wow, on a Thursday. I knew that I needed to draft in crowds. So a lot of the times, because we were doing what you might describe as the crappier nights of the week, where a lot of people from the outskirts of London may not have been able to do the gig and then get home on the last bus or get home on the last train or even afford a taxi home. So what I did from the early days was to offer my flat as a party flat. That way, if there was 10 or 15 core people who were others fans who wanted to really get from Ilford, and big respect to the Ilford Seven, for instance, who were name-checked on the first album back cover. If you want to double-check it, I still remember it from today. But if your kids who are like 15 years old, 16 years old, it's a Wednesday night, you're travelling in from fucking Ilford in the middle of nowhere, and you need somewhere to stay so that you can party and then get up for work at 6 a.m, 7 a.m. next morning and then go back to work like nothing's happened. That was the only way I could initially see of growing a community, which is the 853 Kamikaze Stage Diving Division, by being able to offer a place where we could all party after the gig. Everybody could sleep on the floor. Next day, everybody go off to work and we start again. And that's how we initially built a quite unique community, where it sort of grew from that very organically, but also through a lot of hard work on our behalf, choosing the right support bands as well. You know, it's like Tom's a person that, you know, if we'd never chose him as the support band and got him on our first tour, maybe his life might not have been the same as it is today.
Yeah, we played some really good shows together, didn't we? And like, was we both on that bill at the Rhythm Factory? I was gonna butt in with like playing on Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock, but remember when we played at like 3 a.m. at the Rhythm Factory and in those like all-nighter gigs?
Yeah, I mean, I remember getting you on the bill for the Rhythm Factory gigs, and I remember getting you the support, if you remember, the Scala gig that we did, which
yeah,
was
I remember
the big
that
gig. You know, it's 1,000 people, and then I got the Paddingtons as support, I put the Supernovas as support, and I put the Unstrung as support. So I always remain loyal to all of the bands that I introduced, you know.
But you did feel like a big part of the community back then, and there was that vibe to it all.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, first of all, you know, I described the sort of early days where you were sorting out, you know, places for people to stay. Then as we got bigger and we became the main band on the bill, I got to choose support slots, hence choosing the Paddingtons from Hull to be our support band on our first tour.
Yeah.
You know, I remember we signed for Alan McGee and they were going like, why do you want to choose a band from Hull as your support band? And I'm like, well, I think they'd be a good support band. And, you know, don't you want a bit more of a name? You know, someone from London, someone bigger. And by then, you know, Tom wasn't signed to Pop Tones and I was signed, and I said, no, I'm really insistent on it. So I tried to give breaks all the time to support bands. That kind of brought their community into my community by choosing them as a support band.
Yeah.
So you had a load of Paddingtons fans that became others fans and vice versa.
Yeah.
You had a load of Cribs fans because we did a joint tour with the Cribs initially. Which was like a double headline tour. So they got some of our fans and we got some of their fans. And that's how it grew organically. By when I became the sort of headline band, I got the choice of the support bands and I was able to tie in loads of little bands that no one have heard of, which I'll touch upon later. We discussed the old days like they were yesterday. I'd say it was 2.5 years of work before we got signed.
Okay.
I'll give you an idea of what the daily grind was for me in those days. I would be up at 7 a.m. I'd be at work by 8:30. This is Monday, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
By the time Monday had finished at 5:30, I'd go back to the flat, I'd get changed, and then that Monday night, I would either be on the rocks, which was in Shoreditch, which Sean McCluskey ran, or I would be the one in Notting Hill, basement fucking club, what Alan McGee used to run on like a Wednesday, like Death Disco. Or I would be out at like the Buffalo Bar, which used to be out in Islington. Or I'd be at Dirty Water Club, which was over in Tufnell Park. Point is, 5 days a week, I would literally be either going to a concert or a gig, or I would be going to a club night or a records company's gig night, or I would be going to a rehearsal. This was literally my 5 nights a week. I used to end up probably sleeping 3 or 4 hours a night before I went to work the next day. And in the evenings, I repeat the same feat again.
Yeah.
Then at the weekends, I'd have maybe Saturday as our gig or Friday as our gig, and rope in the masses for that. You know, you're playing to initial crowds of 50 to 100. And then on a Sunday, I'd get up at fucking some godforsaken shit hour and go all the way down to Brighton, rehearse for 12 hours in Brighton, come back and start again on the Monday.
So like, you're on record labels radar at that point, do you think?
We had 1, 2, 3 labels who all bid against each other in a buying war.
Right.
You're probably looking for names of the other two labels so that you can reference it. But basically what happened is McGee signed us for the first one. It went to two majors and one independent who all bid against each other. And then we signed for Mercury Vertigo. And Mercury Vertigo are a division of Universal.
Yeah,
but we only got a one album contract with them, which effectively is 18 months. And we got £135,000 for the privilege of signing for them.
Right, wow.
And then off of that 135K, you have to give 20% to your manager for the privilege of helping you sign. I think I paid my lawyer near enough 10 grand. For reading the contract, but he probably made us 30 grand by reading the contract and putting tie-ons and add-ins in.
Yeah.
And then what was left, you know, about 105 grand, was divided four ways. And then that was divided over 18 months. And that was our wages.
Yeah.
Which we survived on. And then on top of that, we had the royalties coming in sort of every 3 months. So, you know, it was a one album contract on a major.
Yeah.
What, you know, I was offered 2 albums on an independent for half of the money. And I was offered 1 album with another major who didn't offer as much money as Universal. So what was I meant to do? Was I meant to go with the independent who's offering me half as much money for 2 albums or get a major for 1 album for 85 more, roughly?
Yeah, yeah.
What'd you do?
Yeah, that's the thing I was saying to Tom with his podcast. It was like, obviously, the advances back then gave bands a bit of breathing space to write more songs.
There was no breathing space.
Oh, okay, right.
As soon as you got the initial single contract,
yeah,
within 9 months or 12, about 9 months or 12 months, the album was basically, I think, out after that.
Okay. Right.
So that had already been written.
Yeah, but I think he means, like, was it a little bit more relaxed, like, for you then going on to write your second album? Because, like, with us, we took quite a lot of time going from the first album to the second album, and like it kind of fucked us up a little bit, you know. We should have probably been a lot quicker with like getting on with making the next record, you know.
I'd look at it, it's like, you know, we toured like fuck from the moment that first single went out.
Yeah.
No, right through to the second album, really. There wasn't much time in between.
We kind of did a similar thing, you know. We do. I can't remember how many gigs we did, because like I just lost count. But we would tour, and that's why we got such a good like scene going on, and like such a good like fan base, and like everyone was like really close, like bands and the fans, you know what I mean? And like, because we toured so much and we did all these little venues to start off with, and we, you know, doing the toilet tour and then going up and up, it was like, it just, the relationship between everybody was just amazing. It was unique. It was unique at the time. Like, and it's because of all the work we put in touring, just made it like kind of special. But do you think things would have been a little bit different if we'd have taken a little bit of time out of touring and just concentrated on making music? Because I don't regret touring at all. Like, obviously that was why we did it, because that was the end product. Like that was the fun and that was the party at the end of it. But I do kind of wish we'd have concentrated on more on making like that second record.
You know, we spoke about this over today, you know, about what I've got. Obviously your questions written down, and I'm gonna dovetail back into those questions. But from what Tom's saying here is that one of the aspects of the others, and Jimmy wrote this down today, who's the bald fat guitarist, and Johnny wrote this down today, who's my Robert Smith lookalike. Both of them said that, you know, one of the things that made us as a band was touring all the time because of the 853 Kamikaze division, doing stage diving all the time. The fact that we had 40 people in the dressing room probably at all times, all of those were fans, and they weren't from sort of maybe your press people, or maybe they weren't from your cool cats kind of people. It was all of the fans backstage, and it was all of the fans that went with us and hung out in hotel rooms and partied together. So I think there was a breakdown in terms of people who looked up to a star. I think it was more like that they felt that they were on the same level as the others, or the same level as the Paddingtons. So I think, you know, for us as a band, we just loved touring. We fucking loved it. And it was sad when it was all over in terms of being able to tour and make a living out of it, you know. We made a good living out of it for 5 years. And for 5 years, I take that. 5 years off of work, I'll take that. I'll take that. Not many people get 5 years off work. We get some criticism over the years. And I could go online and defend myself, but really, I've got a job these days and I go to work. And I've been back at work since, I think, January 2008.
Right, okay.
You know, it's now what, 2020? I've been back at work 12 years. Do I need to really just keep talking about 2004 and 2005? I let a lot of the kind of things that happen online just develop and let them speak for themselves, because it's, you know, you get people who want to write history in different ways. You know, a lot of people talk about the Clash and the Sex Pistols, but not everyone talks about the Adverts. They were a good punk band, you know, and I wonder if history will be repeated a bit the same with us, as a 2005 band, where people will try and write us out of history, a bit like they did with the adverts and the punk bands. You know, people talk about the Buzzcocks and the Damned as well. People don't talk about the adverts. And I'm aware about how music journalists want to write what they feel is the spoils of victory for their bands. It's like when the 2013 album come out, which is the third album.
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever, like, you want to see the press that sort of touched to that. You know, I think we were lucky if we got sort of, you know, the East London Advertiser writing an article about us, or you know, I think maybe the Yorkshire Post, there was an Others fan that wrote an article about us. You know, it was literally, you know, we hardly anyone wrote about the third album, and that was a really big wake-up call to sort of I think us as a band, that we thought, oh yeah, after two albums we might be able to do a third album yourself. But you know, getting press or getting any backing for it, very hard if you're, you know, not part of that machine. I remember when one of Tom's albums, you explored using a different retail outlet. Do you remember that?
On the second record, yeah.
Yeah,
we got investors in, didn't we?
Yeah, like, and you did it through what was it, JB Sports? Yeah.
Yeah, JD.
JD, sorry. So, you know, and Matt, I thought at the time, now I could see that is a really good way, because it's a different outlet for being able to get your record to a different community. So I thought, well, you've got that on top of the record shops, which it traditionally is sold in, plus it's now going through a retail outlet. I thought that was a really good idea. I remember your old man speaking to me about that, and I thought it was a really, really good idea.
Yeah, kind of. When we were recording that second record, it's kind of our last resort, I guess, in a way, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
we had the label at the beginning of the recording, and then by the end of it, we didn't. So changed everything a little bit.
Hey Tom, but it's the same with us, man. We got the second album. After the second album, it was like, you know, we were trying to tout round for a third album. You know, it was like, people were I remember walking into meetings like I was some kind of plague victim, very similar to today with the coronavirus. You know, oh my God, it's Dominic Masters that I'm meeting from the Others. Oh, and I was like, hi, pleased to meet you. You may remember us from four top 40 singles. And the guy's like, I ain't buying, mate. The main thing is, Tom, you've got one album. Most people don't even get one.
Yeah, no, mate, we're all very grateful for that. Do you know what I mean? Like, we had the best time of our lives.
Exactly.
You can't buy that shit.
Totally. That's what I'm saying. I've got 5 years off work. I'm just, you know, 5 years away from work. What more can you want? We discuss the old days like they were yesterday. So in terms of high points then, okay, wow. I don't know if this is a roll call of honour. 2005 New Musical Express Award, so the NME Award that we won, which was the John Peel Award for Innovation in 2005. We thought that was quite a high point. Playing Glastonbury Festival on the other stage at 5 p.m. That was pretty good. We played in Japan twice in two baseball stadiums to like 30,000 people at 11 o'clock in the morning supporting Oasis. That was pretty good.
Yeah.
I don't know. We did the Vice magazine 10th anniversary party in New York as the headline band. Big thank you to Andy Kappa for that. That Vice magazine 10th anniversary gig in New York as the headline band. That was pretty good as well. Then there was those Astoria gigs for the NME tours. Glastonbury 2004 for the John Peel stage. You know, the Steve Lamacq Radio 1 session that we did for Steve Lamacq We enjoyed doing that. Releasing This Is For The Poor was pretty good. The End of the Line tour that we did was good, where we played on a tube train. So, yeah, lots of high points. Lots of high points, mate.
Yes, yeah. I was reading about that tube gig today. That must have been mental. How was the general public reaction to that?
Well, look, you know, it's like it took some organisation. It was a way of maybe demonstrating feeling, you know?
Yeah.
It showed a bit about what we were all about, and it was fun, and it was enjoyable. And it can still, you know, these things can still be repeated today. There's some good new bands out there as well doing some good new stuff.
Yeah.
You know, out of today's bands, I quite like Drala. I think they're up from Yorkshire. I quite like Lewsberg as well. I've been listening to them a bit.
Who's that? Like
Lewsberg. And I like Stanley Brinks. I quite like Kate Le Bon. And I quite like Fat White Family. They're all right.
Oh, yeah.
I like Flatworms as well.
To be honest,
there's lots of good new bands out there. Lots of really good new bands. I'll have to check them out, because
to be honest, with guitar music at the minute, I'm just completely out of the link.
Try those bands. All of them. Meat Raffle are really good as well.
I've heard of them.
They're pretty good. Yeah, I'd say they were some of my highlights.
I usually trust your taste in music, to be honest.
Oh, I've got some good shit in terms of music. Oh, always out there. Yeah, I mean, I try and put the effort in with Mark Riley.
Yeah.
So I do a 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. slot religiously, you know, Monday to Thursday, tune into Mark Riley, work out what the gospel is according to Mark Riley, because he was in The Fall, and because, you know, any man that was in The Fall, you know, you've got to listen to them, because obviously The Fall are my favourite band apart from The Stooges. So when I've got one of The Fall doing a radio slot 4 days a week for 2 hours a day, it's like, you know, it's having like, you know, Jesus and his disciples, like Mark Riley's one of Marky Smith's disciples, and there he is every night whacking out 2 hours of great music. So I get a lot of new bands from Mark Riley, which I'm, you know, grateful to. And also Gideon Coe, the guy that comes on at 9 o'clock. I listen to his show a lot and try and get some good bands from that. So all of those bands that I just spoke about, just stuff that are nicked off of Radio 6 DJs that have informed me, really.
Have you carried on making music, Domma? How have you found that?
In terms of making music, it's a bit tricky. The thing is that you've got problems with the other's logistics is that Eddie lives in Estonia. So that's pretty tricky, you know. So every time we go have a rehearsal, Eddie's got to come over. He just lived with me for 6 months. And we managed to do 3 months of recording. Me, Eddie, Steve McCready, who's a new added bass player to the band. And what we have now is 3 bass players and 4 guitarists. I'm not joking. We got 3 bass players and 4 guitarists.
And how do you find the process of recording? Are you just kind of doing it for the fun of it?
This is what I'm trying to say. The logistical side is fucking a nightmare.
Yeah, so yeah.
I've got one lad in Estonia. Then let me tell you about my drummer. So my drummer lives in the French mountains at the moment. And he was out there for 6 months playing a covers band, right? He got coronavirus. So this is Joseph Gardner Lowe, who's my drummer. And now he's in France and he's stuck out in France. He's just recovering from coronavirus and he's stuck out in the mountains and he's trying to get back to the UK. So that's another one. And then you've got Jimmy and Johnny down in Brighton and Hove. And Jimmy's had a few tricky things with his family to overcome. You know, then there's me, I just go to work. You know, the thing is, it's logistically playing, we're averaging an album every 7 years.
When did you last do a show?
2013, I think, or maybe 2014. I can't quite remember, but it's one of those. It's 2013 or 14, and we're due to record the fourth album probably now, either the end of this year or the start of next year, depending if we can bring all of the planets together.
So you're all still mates, and that's obviously a big positive for a start.
Yeah, well, we're all still mates. What I'd say is that we grow more as a band. So we started at four people, and now we've obviously added Joe and added Eddie, added Steve. So you know, now we're six. So I think we're a bit like Brian Jonestown Massacre. We just add a person every couple of years and grow organically, you know.
Do you beat each other up like they do?
No, we're not great at fighting as a band. We love arguing.
Is there anything you'd have done differently, Dom, looking back at that period, or not really?
No, not at all. I thought about this one. That's just an easy no.
What's gone has gone kind of thing.
Oh, I loved the past. It was wicked. It was so good. I had a really great time. But, you know, that was 15 years ago. It's a long time ago, guys. You know, I've been back at work for 12 years. You know, it's a different life.
Yeah. How would you say if you were obviously still making music now, but say if you guys are starting out now, like, how do you anticipate that it'd be different for you guys with the internet, or would you just carry on the same way?
You know, you've got a bigger playing field now. It should be easier, really, in all accounts.
Yeah.
It's just that people are not into guitar music anymore. That's what's changed. You've got every medium. You've got every accessibility. You've got easy ways of getting in touch with the masses. You can have the best fucking guitar song out there, but no one gives a fuck, really, because no one's into guitar music anymore. That's all, you know? And the demographic has changed, the audience sizes have changed, and you can't make a career out of it. You can if you're a band probably shifting 250,000 albums a year at full price, you know, rate card. I can't see there's much of a living below that, really. And if not, you're scrimping and saving. You know, we were pushing work for 5 years back in a day where internet was driving away your sales then, you know.
Yeah.
If I was a teenager now, would I want to buy an album of a guitar band that I liked? You know, would I want to buy an album of anyone if I can get it for free?
Yeah.
You know, so where's the business model in terms of making any money out of it? But in terms of getting through to the market, yeah, you just need to have the product that connects with the masses. And I don't think guitar music is it.
You think that's why then, that because of, like you said at the beginning, things come and go, different eras. It's just not guitar bands here, it's time,
Things go in cycles.
Yeah.
You know, and this is what I wanted to touch upon when you were sort of saying about bands that were around. You put in a nice question about, you know, favourite bands from that era.
Mm.
And, you know, I think people forget the Parkinsons. You remember the Parkinsons, Tom?
Yeah, they were real good.
Exactly. That's Tom's first reactions. They were real good.
Yeah, like, they were proper. Were they Portuguese or something?
That's right. They were wicked.
Yeah, they were proper punks then.
Too right. I went to see them last year, and like when I see them play, I'll tell you what, Tom. I saw them at Nambuka of all places.
What, last year?
Yeah. Well, you know, they're all in their, you know, late 40s, early 50s. They're fucking brilliant. Really, really good.
I remember you see that. They used to hang about in the Good Mixer a lot, didn't they? Camden.
They were more up where Dirty Water Club is, Tufnell Park. They're all up there. But yeah, I used to like the Parkinsons. I used to like Akara Cult. And Jimmy said his favourite bands of the era was the Paddingtons and the Cribs. And then Johnny's favourite bands of the era was Neil's Children.
Oh, yeah, I remember them.
Remember them, Neil's Children?
Yeah.
They were nice lads, and I like their, I think they used to bring their granddad or their father along as their tour manager. He was a bloody nice chap too. And then underrated bands, right? I wanted to test you on a few of these. So, because obviously, you know, you two,
if you're ready, Tom, yeah.
You two remember every day like yesterday, 15 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
So,
can't remember a fucking thing, to be fair.
So, do you remember the Cherubs?
Yeah, it rings a bell.
We reckon they were the best Norwegian band never signed. Cherubs.
Well, what challenge on that one, Dom?
All right, I reckon they were the best Norwegian band never signed.
I'll take your word for that.
Thank you. Other underrated bands. Now, we reckon you know this one. You might remember it from our Nottingham gigs together. Parties in Belgrade.
That's the name of the band.
Yeah. Can you remember? Parties in Belgrade with Carl Anthony.
Carl Anthony?
Oh, yeah. Those Coventry lads. Remember them?
Anthony
looked a bit like a young Jimi Hendrix.
I can't remember the band, but the name rings a bell.
So Parties in Belgrade.
Everything is a bit of a mush, though, isn't it?
So we remember them. Also, Banjo is band. He's from Wrexham. They played with us a couple of times, but we can't remember the name of his band, but his name is Banjo. And then Joyrides, if you remember them, Joyrides that was Kieran, Ollie, Jib, and Amy. We like them, Joyrides.
Fucking hell, you've got it. You remember the details,
haven't you? Oh, honestly, we've been doing our research today. We only had today to prepare for the interview, and I was trying to remember everybody.
Have you only just discovered Google?
These bands aren't even on Google. And the Supernovas, Joey Sylvester's band.
Yeah, I remember them.
I think they changed their name to Bless, but they used to be called Supernovas. So I'd say we were thinking about it today. They were the underrated band.
I'll tell you, it was not underrated because they smashed it to fairly well, but 80s Matchbox, they were very good then.
Yeah, we did a tour with them,
And obviously the Cribs, like the Cribs topped it off.
Sim, it was quite funny. We met outside of Primark of all places. It was really exciting. You know, I was walking to the swimming pool because I've got problems with my back. Because I've got a slip disc and a trapped nerve in my back. I have to go swimming to try and sort my back out. And I was walking past Primark, and there was Sim from the 80s Beeline Matchbox Disaster stood outside Primark. And I thought, wow, it's come to this. It was a bit like some scene out of a Western. There we were, two old sea-level rock celebrities meeting outside Primark as I was on the way to repair my bad back.
Rock celebrities.
I know. It had come to this, and I said to Sim, wow, fancy meeting you outside Primark. these are the days I live now. We discuss the old days like they were yesterday. Right, with the 853 Kamikaze Stage Dove and Division over the years, we were such like a large flock. So, you know, initially we had Let's Kill the Others. Do you remember that, Tom?
Yeah, I do remember that, yeah.
And that was just like, you know, the long website name. And everybody would click there onto the forum. And then you would have regional 853 Kamikaze Stage Diving Divisional members in Wolverhampton, Coventry, Newcastle, Brighton, London, whatever, and they could all hang out with each other and meet up with each other. And, you know, I think a lot of what's needed now, if Qatar bands, you know, are going to be able to, maybe that you two were adhering to earlier, you know, sort of to be able to grow back to those glory days that, you know, you can make a living out of it. It's going to need connection with your communities once again, and people putting in that effort that maybe we did back in 2005 to reach out to people. You know, if you're not in connection constantly these days, whether it's via a Twitter, Facebook, Bandcamp medium, and it's not, you know, it's one of your selling points that you're not in touch with. And personally, I haven't got that level of time anymore to devote to the band, because it doesn't pay me enough to pay my gas bill or my electricity bill or my water bill or, you know, my internet or my food bills or shopping at Lidl, you know. And I think that's the realization, I think, for a lot of people now, is they've just got to go, okay, you know, 2005, it was brilliant times, but you just got to reevaluate. And just sort of think, okay, what have I got to do to pay the rent? You've got to look at it like this. Okay, so the Fall, yeah, we all love the Fall now. But maybe people didn't love the Fall back in the 90s, just put it like that, okay? Or let's look at the Stooges now, but let's look at the Stooges in the 1990s, the 1980s, in terms of where they were in people's consciousness. Because all I'm saying is it took sort of the Stooges and the Fall something in the region of 40 years to really get the record sales and recognition that your Rolling Stones and your Beatles and the Who already had. Is all I'm saying is maybe, you know, for a revival, 15 years, no way. You're looking at 25 to 40 years before you can have a proper revival. 25 minimum.
Yeah.
You know, I remember seeing The Damned. I'll just put this into perspective. I saw The Damned in 1996. So that would have been, what, 20 years? Just 20 years after punk.
Yeah,
and I saw them play to 500 people at the Garage, right? And Captain Sensor was in a particular drunk period of his life then. My point is, you know, if you're playing the Garage and you're one of the founders of punk rock 20 years later to 500 people, what are the others going to be playing in 5 years? What are the Paddingtons going to be playing in 5 years?
Yeah.
About 500 people, yeah, that's probably our level.
Funny story or a Liam Gallagher story or something?
Oh, this one we were thinking about today.
Okay.
This is about Ian Brown. So it was the Glastonbury Festival 2005, and it was pissing down with rain. I played a successful gig on top of the Others stage, so we were in heroic moods, but it was raining, and it was raining heavy. So it was hard to find anywhere to shelter. So my band, as Tom knows, generally, I didn't party with my band, as Tom will tell you. I used to party with Jeff, who's my roadie, and Alan, who was my roadie.
Oh, Jeff.
You remember Jeff Catani?
Yeah.
And Alan Jules. So they were my sort of go-to best friends, because the other lads in the band at the time probably needed a bit of space from me. So both Alan and Jeff would look after me from time to time. And we needed to find somewhere we could smoke, and we needed to find somewhere that was dry. So I managed to find somewhere backstage that was kind of like where all the crew people were hanging out. Not really a celebrity show or a celebrity shower, just basic crew and runners at the back of the festival where I noticed there was a place where we could smoke under a tarpaulin. So that's why I went there. I got there and a guy comes up to me, says, "Hello, are you Dominic?" And I was like, "Yeah, I am." And he's like, "I'm Ian Brown's cousin." I said, "Wow, you're Ian Brown's cousin, are you? That's pretty impressive." I said, "Look, I don't give a fuck whether you're Ian Brown's cousin or not. Look, just hang out with us. You seem like a good bloke." And we spent a few hours in that tent just drinking and smoking. I said, "Where are you staying?" And he goes, "Look, I've got nowhere to stay. I'm on an access all areas pass because I'm Ian Brown's cousin." I said, "What, and he didn't give you any place to stay?" He goes, "No, I just got the ticket." And I was like, "Fair enough. Why don't you come and sleep in our van and you can sleep with the rest of the band and the roadies. We've got a rolled up mattress in the back of a transit van and you can sleep there for the night because it's pissing down. If you haven't got a tent, you can sleep at our place." He's like, "Yeah, that's brilliant, man." So he come back to us. We did what we did in the night in terms of partying. Got up in the morning. He goes, "I just want you to know, I'm Ian Brown's cousin." I said, "Look, I'm so glad that you've told me this. And I hope our paths will meet again one day." So 3 months passed. And 3 months pass, and they pass along. I'm wondering, where is Ian Brown's cousin? I get to play in Scotland, and I get to play a festival called Tea in the Park, and we got a quite favourable slot. And we were very lucky to have that favourable slot. Now, Snoop Dogg was playing that festival as the headline act, and he had his own basketball court that was supplanted in the backstage at Tea in the Park.
I remember this. We were there.
You were there too, I know.
That's why I'm telling the story.
So what happens is, I'm the lead singer of The Others, obviously. And, you know, it needed to be known that Snoop Dogg and me should meet. But the problem was that there was a lot of security guards around the supplanted basketball court. So I had no option. Because if me and Snoop were going to meet, I was going to need to run onto that court and say, "Snoop, it's me, Dominic Masters from The Others. I know you've been waiting for me." So I ran onto the court, ducked a couple of minders, got within touching distance of the great Snoop, just about to shake his hand as I was winched up off my feet, pulled back, put on the side of the court, told never fucking come onto this court again. And the whole crowd cheered at my ludicrous attempt to see Snoop Doggy Dogg. In the meantime, subsequently, I was slightly exhausted and I needed to go back to my dressing room. I walked back to the dressing room and I sat in my cabin and did what I did. And there was a knock at the door. I thought, "Oh, shit. It's going to be Snoop Dogg's minders trying to, like, eject me from the site. Or it's my manager telling me we've been dropped off the bill because of my antics running onto the basketball court to try and meet Snoop Doggy Dogg." I open the door. It's Ian Brown. I say, "Hello, Ian. What are you doing here?" He says, "I need to speak to you, and I need to speak to you in detail." I said, "Great. Is there ever take a friend with me? You know, phone a friend." Ian Brown's looking a bit serious at this point. And after what I'd just done on the basketball court to try and shake Snoop Doggy Dogg's hand, I was thinking maybe Ian Brown's been sent in as a peacemaker. So I say, "Alan, do you want to hold my hand?" He goes, "Oh, yeah, I've always wanted to meet Ian Brown." That's my best Geordie accent, by the way. I say, "Come on, Alan, we're going to go and meet Ian Brown." So we trot on off to go and sit in Ian Brown's cabin. Ian Brown says, "Take a seat. I'm shitting it. Alan's shitting it. said, do you smoke grass? I said, yeah, I smoke grass. Might be a good time to start smoking even more. Because it was getting a bit serious. So he hands me this carrier bag, a Tesco bag of skunk. And I happily sat there and made my joint of skunk. He said, you may be wondering why I've called you to this dressing room. I said, yeah, really, I was. He said, well, it's nothing too serious, but you can tell the look on his face. He's a very serious chap. He goes, I just wanted you to know, you met Ian Brown's cousin. I said, did I? He said, you know, you did a really good thing looking after my cousin that night, and it was pissing down with rain, and he never let it out of my mind to tell you to meet you. And then there was a knock at Ian Brown's door. He said, I want you to go over and answer that door. So I walked over and answered the door, opened the door, and he goes, told you I was Ian Brown's cousin, didn't I? I told you I was Ian Brown's cousin. I told you. And that's how I met Ian Brown, and I met Ian Brown's cousin as well.
Excellent.
So, yeah, that's probably one of my stories over the years of hanging out with people that probably didn't want to hang out with me.
Sounds like Ian Brown's cousin did.
Well, I don't know. I just think Ian Brown's cousin that night just wanted somewhere to stay that was warm. And he thought using the caveat of being Ian Brown's cousin would be enough to get him somewhere to sleep.
How many people do you think he tried that on?
Exactly. But we didn't give a fuck cousin. We just thought he was a really funny lad, really easy to get on with. We had a smoke and a drink with him. He was a great laugh. And I didn't want him to say he was his cousin at all once. I just wanted him to shut up about being Ian Brown's cousin and just hang out, you know? We discussed the old days like they were yesterday. It's been just nice to speak to you both. If there is anybody out there that potentially listens to this podcast in the future that's thinking, where can I find this band, The Others? You know, maybe they're the missing link in the food chain of rock and roll bands. And then you can find The Others' first album, self-titled, and The Others' Inward Parts, and The Others' Songs for the Disillusioned on Bandcamp, and you can get them all for free.